You are listening to the Health and Wellness Connection Podcast, the number one wellness podcast designed to provide the latest information to help you achieve your health and wellness goals. Our show features exciting guests, the latest in medical research, and in-depth discussions in current trends on weight loss, nutrition, and fitness. No matter what your interest, the Health and Wellness Podcast has you covered. And now, presenting your illustrious host, Dr. Barry, MD.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the Health and Wellness Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Barry, and I want to thank you for joining us for another informative episode. We hope that, you know, information that we're providing has been helping you kind of figure out this whole corona pandemic and kind of how the best way to move around. We're going to talk about some of the latest news regarding the coronavirus and a lot of good information out there that's really, you know, shedding more light on what exactly the corona is involved in, what it's doing, and how it's affecting the populace. Again, just before we get to the nitty-gritty details, want to again remind you guys, please check out the website anchor.fm/HW Connection. This is a podcast homepage. You can check out our site. You can donate as well to the show if you want to support. You know, the show does try to produce every week, courtesy of myself and some of the my colleagues over at Afro Vibes Radio, which you also need to check out as well. Please download our app as well for awesome, awesome Afrobeat nonstop, and it's free. So it's really no excuse. Live DJs, you know, mix and produced by really DJs all over the world. So I want to stress really how a great deal that is. So check out Afro Vibes Radio. You will not regret it. So again, we're talking about the coronavirus. We got a lot of topics that we're going to cover today, as well as some new research that's really on the horizon that will hopefully shape the treatment for coronavirus going forward. So worldwide, we're about at 2 million cases. A little over 2 million cases recovered is about 500,000 people have gotten the virus and recovered, and about 130,000 people have died from the virus. So definitely a very significant global effect. One thing, though, that we're seeing is that a lot of the different cities and states and countries that have instituted lockdowns have been so for about 30 days now. So we're starting to see some of the effects of some of these lockdown measures. Particularly, we're seeing reduced new infections as well as reduced deaths all across the board. So I think, thankfully, the measures that are being put in place by the various municipalities, which is also a source of quite a bit of controversy as well, have really done quite a bit to help improve the overall effect that the coronavirus infections have had on the various hospital systems. I think after seeing the various hospitals in northern Italy being overwhelmed and certain hotspots, including New York, you know, they're just the intense number of patients and issues that they're still dealing with. I think a lot of those measures put in place worldwide have helped reduce some of that intense onslaught you're seeing in some of these really badly affected cities. So the thing about the coronavirus is that, you know, while things are getting better, you know, it's one of those diseases that is believed that it's mutating quite rapidly and will likely come back for the next few seasons. So, you know, really getting an idea on how coronavirus hurts and kills people and how it infects and spreads is very important, because it seems like something that we're going to have to deal with for the foreseeable future. So one thing that's really kind of concerning that we're noticing with this coronavirus is that people who are known to have pre-existing conditions, which is really a general term, we're going to talk about that more in detail, but there are certain populations that are seemingly far more susceptible to some of the more catastrophic effects of a coronavirus infections, which is mainly the severe pneumonia, the double pneumonia that puts people in the hospital and reduces their inability to breathe or oxygenate their blood. One thing we're seeing is that obesity is really shown to have a pretty significant link to your likelihood of getting a very severe complication from coronavirus. Because, you know, coronavirus is one of those bugs that it has a very odd or a very unique pattern. It tends to not really affect young children. young adults, relatively healthy adults, those typically do very well with coronavirus infections. In fact, some of these people can actually have an active infection, but don't show any symptoms. And they're also very contagious during this period as well. So these people are actually believed to be implicated in really spreading the virus quite rapidly in the communities. Now, most viruses like the flu, for instance, will have a 1 to 2 day incubation period where you're kind of technically infectious, but you're not really having symptoms. So you may be out and about thinking you're fine. And then maybe that evening you get a fever and you really get really fatigued. Coronavirus, for instance, however, though, you have a 5 to 7 day incubation period. So a very long time of someone can be infected and still be extremely contagious. We talked about this in previous shows. Check out the other 4 or 5 shows we've done on the coronavirus, and especially break it down the coronavirus, really go into detail as far as how it is spread. So check that out if you want more information on that. But either way, the coronavirus is one of those viruses that can spread very rapidly due to the fact it has a long incubation period. Therefore, it's very, contagious. The reason why this is important, because certain communities that have high levels of obesity are seemingly getting more devastated from this coronavirus infection. One actually study that came out that really showed more about this link between obesity and increased complications was one that actually was recently done out of New York. We all know New York is a very hard hit community from this coronavirus pandemic. But there was one particular study that was done where they really looked at patients who were admitted to the hospital for coronavirus infections. And they looked at those who lived, those who died, their overall, need for mechanical ventilation and other signs of really difficult hospital stays. And one thing that was determined, it was noted that people who were admitted were almost always over 65 or morbidly obese, obese. They would technically have BMIs greater than 28 or higher. And that really comes down to body fat percentage. So it was definitely something that was very consistently seen in this New York study that recently just came out. This also a similar association. Yes, there was a French study that was recently conducted in France, in Lille, France, actually, where they saw that in a recent analysis of their ICU patients, almost 70% were obese. Now, when you break that down, those who had a BMI greater than 30, which is considered obesity, and then severe obesity is greater than 35 BMI, most of the people, 47%, actually just had a BMI 30 and up. And those who were severely overweight had even higher levels of mechanical ventilation in the ICUs. So obesity is an extremely significant factor, or predictor, I should say, for severe illness and potentially overall poor outcomes when dealing with a COVID-19 infection. So it really just kind of put a new light on those communities, especially in the United States of America, who are more susceptible to this illness. And obesity seems to be a common factor. The reason why this is also important, because one thing that's also being seen across COVID hotspots throughout the United States is that African Americans also been heavily affected as far as the death rates. Many communities, including Detroit, Chicago, in the Midwest, Milwaukee, Illinois, even New Orleans, African Americans are comprising the higher numbers of those succumbing to the infection. Now, one thing with this link with obesity we're seeing is that it's possible that the fact that higher rates of obesity are also seen in the African American community may also be contributing to some of the increased poor outcomes in the community as well. Now, we also mentioned in the previous show that, of course, systematic racism is likely a big factor as well, since that many studies have shown how African Americans could be potentially be minimized as far as their symptoms or not be taken as seriously as patients. So that obviously is going to contribute to potential poor outcomes. But this new link as far as obesity is also quite important as well, and kind of goes to show kind of the importance of our show, what we've been talking about for the past few years. Of course, hopefully, the obesity epidemic is nothing new. If you've been listening to the show, we've been yelling about this for the past 2-3 years or so. In fact, the book I was lucky enough to author Next Level Weight Loss 2.0. Please check that out if you want some information regarding how to lose weight. And we go deep into the obesity epidemic currently going on and really kind of break down ways to overcome obesity by reevaluating how you look at food. Again, Next Level Weight Loss 2.0. Please check it on Amazon. Either way, so the obesity epidemic is real, and it's possible, it's likely that this coronavirus is actually, you know, exposing that, you know, disparity in the health of certain populations, as well as, you know, affecting those people or those nations, particularly the United States, that have high prevalence of obesity. And so with the American obesity rate of 42%, clearly we're at higher risk of far more morbidity and mortality from this infection than, say, China, which has about a 6% obesity rate, or Italy, which actually has about a 10% obesity rate, and they still are having significant issues battling the virus. So because of this, many people predicting that the United States will likely have the most fatalities from this infection. So it's really important that, you know, we kind of understand the dangers of potentially not taking our health seriously. It was believed that, you know, with the advent of a lot of modern medical techniques, especially fighting some of the common ailments associated with obesity, like coronavascular arterial disease, as well as cerebrovascular disease or strokes. And the first one, of course, is heart attacks and so forth. We have, you know, fancy techniques to help, you know, open arteries once they get clogged up with inflammatory tissue, and other fancy devices to get inside the brain and open up for, you know, acute blockages, and all that stuff is fantastic. However, the idea is to try to avoid getting to that position, and that's by trying to do the best you can to, you know, eat whole foods, try to drink a lot of water, you know, reduce inflammation, you know, try to maintain a healthy, balanced diet. Things like this can be essential in reducing some of those known issues that we know obesity can cause, or prevent those issues, I should say. But you also want to keep your immune system in check and at tip-top shape so that you can be able to fight off infections like this, you know, novel coronavirus bug that's terrorizing the human populace. So, you know, it's something that, you know, really echoes the importance of obesity and managing that. And hopefully this will put an impetus into the, you know, the United States and other nations to promote anti-obesity measures and ensure that people understand the potential health risks of obesity. So that being said, let's talk more about, again, other potential risks that may be affecting the African-American community. Another one is the exposure to the virus by quote-unquote essential workers. These are people working in the various markets, be it the grocery stores, bus drivers, delivery agents, so forth. There's also been noted that there's a lot of people who are doing these jobs who may not be able to not work due to, you know, potential exposure because of the financial issues that they may be dealing with. And this has caused a belief that many folks who are potentially of lower income may be forced to continue to work in despite having dangerous occupational risks. And unfortunately, a lot of these jobs are occupied by African Americans. So it's also another belief that the lower socioeconomic status of many individuals in the African American community is also, you know, causing the increased exposure, which is also causing the increased risk of death. So it's so important that we kind of, you know, learn to address these here as we address the response to this coronavirus and making sure that we're protecting all of our workers. One thing I'm a big advocate of is a paid leave. So people who are sick are encouraged to stay home and continue to get a check so that they do not potentially, you know, expose others at the job. So it's very important that we kind of figure out something. Hopefully government can come in and help us as well. But something will definitely need to be done, because things like people working sick is one of the reasons why this virus will be harder to control, because people are still interacting with others in a work environment despite the fact they're very contagious. So again, a lot of things that are going to be, you know, changed due to this whole coronavirus, and hopefully they are for the better. So good news is that, you know, not all doom and gloom. We do have some great news regarding treatments. We're going to talk about those after the break. A lot of different things on the horizon, a lot of different questions being asked. So let's talk more about some of the new treatments potentially that could help manage this whole coronavirus pandemic. And also, we're going to touch a bit on some of the vaccine controversy. So again, guys, stay tuned. It's your host, Dr. Barry. More coming up after the break. Peace. Hello, 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 and welcome back to the Health and Wellness Connection. It's your host, Dr. Barry, here again, talking more about the coronavirus and, you know, the things that are kind of coming on the horizon regarding, you know, treatment. That's one thing that we are seeing. The coronavirus is potentially starting to learn more about it as far as how to treat it. And there are some medications that are, while controversial, are something that we could use to potentially fight the infection going forward. Now, we all know that treatment has been a very controversial topic, and there are a couple drugs that have been announced in various ways. First up, we know the one that President Donald J. Trump apparently was very excited about, and that was hydroxychloroquine. Now, we know that hydroxychloroquine is a drug that's been around for a while. It's a drug that was initially designed to fight malaria. Chloroquine, which was actually the initial formation of the drug, started developing a resistance amongst those who were using it for malaria. At least scientists or doctors back then noticed it. So hydroxychloroquine was created instead. Now, hydroxychloroquine itself is still a medication that's still used for malaria. Now, there's actually other malaria drugs that are actually considered more effective, but hydroxychloroquine is still believed to be quite effective for most types of malaria. However, because of, you know, it's kind of been supplanted by other more fancier malarial meds, it's still kind of went on the back burner for that particular condition. However, it's actually got new life as a medication to be used typically to treat rheumatoid arthritis. Many rheumatologists use it as well to help reduce some of the inflammatory processes seen in various joint arthropathies like rheumatoid arthritis. And that's where it's kind of enjoyed its kind of a sunset, if you will. Now that malaria, while still a problem in many parts of Africa and South America, is definitely not as prevalent as it was back in the early 1900s and mid-1900s when this drug was really all the rage. Now, that being said, hydroxychloroquine has now been, you know, in the news lately, obviously, with the recent coronavirus pandemic. And the reason why it became kind of a drug that people were looking at as a potential treatment was because the Chinese scientists initially who looked at it were showed some promising information regarding hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin use in patients who had severe coronavirus infections. And it showed that some patients were improving. Now, there was a lot of controversy with this study. And there was also another study done by some French scientists as well. And they showed some improvement. It was another small study as well. We talked about this as well on previous shows. Please look at some of the earlier shows where we kind of just go into this hydroxychloroquine discussion. But there was some optimistic signs in both those studies and got folks excited about the potential for it to be used as a potential treatment. Now, it's not the first time hydroxychloroquine has been considered something to be used in an antiviral setting, because one thing that's seen in the lab when hydroxychloroquine is being studied is that it actually can help reduce viral replication in cells in vitro. And that's what we mean outside of the body. Now, the reality is that even though in a petri dish, hydroxychloroquine bathed cells may not get infected with a viral infection, once this process occurs in the body, viruses behave very differently. So this is why it's not really, you know, hydroxychloroquine hasn't been this super antiviral bug. We don't give it for flu, we don't give it for HIV, or really nothing else. So that's why there's a lot of skepticism on whether hydroxychloroquine could potentially work to reduce COVID-19 infections. Now, as we said previously, there are some studies that have shown that viral replication is reduced in people who are taking hydroxychloroquine, but it's not enough evidence to show whether or not it definitively helps clear infections and have people test negative, which is something that is yet to be proven. Now, that being said, there are a lot of studies currently ongoing. There's one study in Detroit currently going on. I think it's Henry Ford or one of these hospitals that actually NIH has funded a study to help, you know, get patients and test them with hydroxychloroquine and see if it actually works. Also another big study going on in Nashville, I want to say. So a lot of hospitals are actually starting to test this, and we're going to have more data here over the next few months. And hopefully this question will be definitively answered if hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin are effective treatments for COVID-19. Now, there's not the only drug here that is getting a lot of attention. Another drug that's been also on the news lately is a recent drug, or not recent, but it's a relatively new drug known as remdesivir. Now, this drug is produced by Gilead scientists. This is a biochemical lab, huge lab that's, has centers all over the globe. But they developed this drug as a strong antiviral medication to help reduce what we call certain viruses known as RNA viruses. Now, I don't want to get too deep into the nitty-gritty of biology here, but you have two big major kind of viruses, RNA viruses and DNA viruses. Most important thing you have to understand is RNA viruses are a certain class of virus that have to switch their genetic code to DNA before they can act. And so these medication, this remdesivir, blocks this virus from replicating by inhibiting its ability to create that DNA so it can start making new protein and start making new viruses, which is how it infects the cell. So the drug remdesivir was actually initially created during the Ebola pandemic. And of course, the Ebola pandemic occurred during 2014 to 2016, when, of course, President Obama was in office, which, you know, we had our issues with Obama, but definitely the competency level was a lot higher. And the reason why that's important, because they created an entire response team and everything regarding the Ebola pandemic, and a lot of things were being done at the time. One thing that actually happened during that period was that Gilead Sciences actually worked, I guess, with NIH to create an antiviral, and remdesivir is that virus. Now, that medication. Now, this medication was actually created to fight the Ebola virus because it was a strong virus to attack, the Ebola type viruses that cause the Ebola infection. However, when Gilead scientists created this medication, they actually tested it on coronaviruses and SARS viruses and MERS viruses, which are other viruses that were known to cause pandemics. And it was shown actually to be effective in reducing the viral replication of those other kinds of viruses. So it's kind of interesting how, you know, medications that were already created for other purposes became useful for new purposes. So, and again, when I say useful, they are essentially just studies that have shown some preliminary improvements in patients who have been taking these medications. But again, remdesivir, while it's been extensively tested in animals and in laboratory settings in vitro, it's shown to decrease replication of coronaviruses in a petri dish, but it's not really shown to do it consistently in humans yet. Now, of course, there are a lot of anecdotal stories of people who have taken these medications and who are actually improving. A lot of those to the point where the government has allowed now companies and physicians and hospitals to use this medication on a compassionate care basis, meaning patients who are deteriorating to the point that they're potentially going to die and there's really nothing else that has been successful. Remdesivir is now approved by FDA to be used to treat patients and to see if there's an improvement. And, you know, because this is a very, you know, touch and go situation, a lot of data is being collected and a lot of studies are being conducted to see if this drug is actually effective. And the fact of the matter is, if it is becomes effective, which a lot of people hope it will be, that it'll be now a very effective way to fight this infection and help reduce the, you know, deadliness of this virus. Because we all know that the virus particularly causes problems when it overwhelms the system, causes systemic inflammation, reduces the body's ability to breathe by attacking the lungs specifically. It also can attack the brain, the kidneys, the heart, and just really all parts of the organs by reducing oxygen that those organs can get. So it's just a very devastating virus. So the idea of reducing the virus's replication abilities in the body are extremely, you know, important. It's something that a lot of antiviral therapies have tried to attack. This is also similar how the everyone's favorite antiviral Tamiflu is used to fight the flu virus. So again, the treatments are very kind of experimental at this time. Another treatment that's also being explored, another very experimental treatment, is an anti-cancer treatment, rituximab. Hold on one second. Actually, not rituximab, sorry, ruxolitinib. And this is a strong antiviral designed to suppress the immune system. And, you know, there's a lot of different things that are being explored. But one of the more controversial treatment plans, and we're going to do a whole show on this as well, so stay tuned for that. But, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about vaccines and why vaccines have always, you know, been a treatment style that many people have looked toward to help treat these kind of infections. Now, the thing is with vaccines is that vaccines are effective because they actually help the body's immune system mount an immune response to an infectious organism. A good example of kind of the whole process of vaccinations and why they are believed to be effective is that when your body gets infected by any virus, for that matter, like the flu virus or whatnot, your body creates antibodies which help fight the virus, neutralize it, and eliminate it from your body. Now, some people's immune systems are weaker than others, so some people who get infected by a virus may not be able to mount an effective response, and they end up succumbing to the virus. Others who have stronger immune systems are able to mount an effective immune response, and they can eliminate the virus. Now, those antibodies are extremely valuable because now those antibodies are able to give the person who developed that, you know, that response and immunity to that virus, so they can no longer really become sick from it because the body will zap it and knock it out as soon as it comes into contact with it. Now, this COVID virus is actually believed to mutate, so we're not sure how immune you become because the virus is such a highly mutagenic virus. It mutates very rapidly. It's very possible that even if you fight off the initial wave, you may get reinfected, which is being seen in certain populations. However, because of this whole process, it's been very, important as far as finding a way to create a vaccine. And many companies have decided to develop different processes to create their own vaccine to try and be the first to create a successful vaccine, which can allow the body to fight create antibodies to fight this virus effectively. Now, the thing about that is that it's a little bit more difficult than a medication. And that being said, it still needs to be tested. So that is also something that's being done, you know, throughout the world, actually. Many countries have actually decided to take on the whole vaccine race, if you will. Now, the reality is there's a lot of money in this race. The first company to really create a successful vaccine will likely, you know, have a financial windfall. And because of this, people are suspicious that many companies doing this with other nefarious intentions. It's unfortunate because vaccines are very, very important in the fight of any, especially viral infections, because the body is sometimes a tricky beast, and creating an effective method of fighting an infection is one of the really important tasks of helping you develop an immunity to a certain infection. So, and the vaccines have been an effective way to help reduce that virus's deadliness, if you will. Like we said before, a good example of this would be like the smallpox epidemic that was quite dangerous back in the smallpox pandemic of the 1870s to the 1875s, where smallpox really just really wiped out about 500,000 people. And the way they determined that smallpox was able to be treated was they were able to take the antibodies of individuals who were exposed to cowpox, which is a similar infection that was caused by a similar organism that caused the smallpox. And so those people who had cowpox, they were able to have their, you know, blood drawn, and that blood was used to treat patients who had smallpox, which helped stop the, you know, spread of smallpox. Now, a similar process is being used to treat COVID infections. The blood of people who have survived COVID infections are now being used, where those antibodies are being extracted and used to treat other patients who are suffering from COVID infections. And there's actually quite a bit of success being seen with this practice. I know it's going on in hospitals here in Houston. It's also going on in hospitals in New York and other parts of the country and the globe, for that matter. It's even described in China initially during their COVID pandemic. So, you know, antibodies are going to be key. And so how we get these antibodies is going to be really important. Some companies have actually decided to synthetically create these antibodies by copying, using various supercomputers, other antibodies created by human beings who had the COVID infection. So a lot of science is going on. The treatments are going to be pretty exciting when they do come out. And we're going to talk more about this whole, you know, vaccine controversy, even that's causing rifts between Trump and Anthony Fauci, the current head of the the current head of the pandemic response for the COVID-19 treatment. So we're going to talk more about all that in a future show, but you know, definitely there's a lot of positive news on the horizon regarding this overall pandemic, as well as the potential treatment options that are upcoming on the horizon. So stay tuned for that. We're going to cover those, of course, when they come out. In the meantime, you guys stay healthy. Prevention is key. Social distancing is an important thing. Keep doing it. Try to reduce exposure to other people and just stay safe, guys. You know, it's a scary world out there, but I think, you know, with information, you know, we're going to be able to navigate through it just fine. So again, it's your host, Dr. Barry. Stay tuned for more shows in the future. Peace.
Thank you for listening to the Health and Wellness Podcast. For more info, check us out on Facebook at www.facebook.com/nextlevelweightloss. Our show can also be found on SoundCloud at www.soundcloud.com/HW Connection. Lastly, for any inquiries, email us at drbarryhealth@gmail.com. Until next time.